Hello, I'm Radek.
I'm Michael.
And this is the podcast.
A sounding board for interesting ideas and insights.
We discuss books to read I want to share with you.
As well as technology and productivity, which is what we do, working our app, Nosby.
Or whatever else comes to mind. So today is a special episode because we record live from
your home. From my home office slash no office.
Yeah.
This is the famous Michael Sliwinski office where normally nobody from the company ever shows up. But this time, Radek changed the course of the history to be the first employee here. So, yeah.
It just sort of happened by accident.
Exactly. So we are here in my home office, now office. And again, this is the first time my office has seen anyone else than me. So
yeah, today we had the design fight and we're both standing at Michael's desk.
Yes.
And it was really strange to like be next to each other and see this room from inside and not just through the one perspective I know through this IMAX behind this camera as I normally see it.
And it was funny because when we were discussing things, I wasn't sure how to talk to you, whether to turn to you or just talk to the screen, and you would see it on the screen anyway.
Like it was actually really weird because it felt weird for me to turn to you, and I mostly just watched you on the screen as I normally do, even though I was on the same picture.
Yeah, it was funny.
Yeah, it was funny. And it's also strange because like I sort of knew it, but I guess I didn't fully internalize that this is a standing desk and you're always standing while we record the podcast or when we have the design fight.
Yeah, yeah.
And my legs are not used to this. So that was difficult.
Yeah, the thing with the stand-up desk is the fact that you have to get used to it. The first days are really hard, and because we as humans are not used to standing so much, we are used to sitting and as knowledge workers. But once you get used to it, and it's fine, then your legs know how to cope, and then you have the straight position and everything, and you're fine. I don't stand the whole 8 hours when I work. I change from standing and sitting, and this desk can be lowered and can go up and down. So it's very useful and I like it. And especially when I have my whiteboard here, it's for me like, you know, I can type something, go to whiteboard. I don't have to stand up to go to whiteboard, to the whiteboard. I can just turn, write something, you know, and keep, I feel more like in action.
Yeah, you do that a lot actually.
Yeah, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, so there's another reason why today is special or might be special, we'll see, because it's the 6th of February.
Look at his t-shirt.
Yeah, I have a Cosmos t-shirt, and if it goes well, then tonight, Central European time, the Falcon Heavy will have its first flight. And Falcon Heavy at this time, if it launches successfully, will be the most powerful operational rocket in the world.
Launching for the first time.
Yeah, launching for the first time. It's also extremely likely that it will get delayed, but hopefully by the time this episode is published, it will launch or it will blow up on the pad. Probably not, but either way, it's going to be spectacular.
Exactly. And today we have scheduled watching it.
Yeah.
And that's why we decided let's talk about space exploration, right?
That's right. And let's talk about the Space Exploration Technologies Company, or SpaceX.
Right. Well, he's the guy who knows stuff about this, and he has the t-shirt to qualify him as an expert.
And socks.
And socks. Oh, and socks as well, right? I forgot about that. So, too much detail. And in my case, I am this novice who is kind of interested because I've seen a few launches of SpaceX. I am following Elon Musk's career. I have read his biography, as we mentioned in the past, one of our past episodes. Link in the show notes. So I'm kind of curious, but I don't have that much knowledge. I'm not that curious. So it's going to be interesting.
Yeah. So I thought we should talk about SpaceX a little bit, but from like with the podcast twist. So we talk a lot about the way we work, the way we organize our work at Nosby.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of what we do and discuss has to do with sort of efficiency and doing things differently, like how to do things we're proud of, like how to make a good business while having, you know, few resources. Like we are It's not a big company. We don't have as many people, but we still want to make a great product. And
a product that serves hopefully thousands and if not millions of people around the world.
Exactly. And how to do it. Like it takes some creativity and like breaking assumptions and changing things, doing things differently. Like the fact that we don't have an office, like everybody works remotely. Like our companies do that too, of course, but like the all of those little things that we do like contribute to it being possible for us to be a small company and still do still make a good product. And the interesting thing is that SpaceX, now a multi-billion dollar company, sure, and SpaceX right now has I believe something like 7,000 employees.
Wow.
So it's not small, okay, but it is really interesting because they make it's pretty much the only innovation in space exploration in rocketry in the last 20 years.
Yeah.
And it started just as a very small company run by this weird millionaire.
Yeah.
And yet it became successful and it innovates. It finally achieved reusability.
Yeah.
Of rockets, which wasn't really done before, except for space shuttle, but with a caveat, which I'll get to in a second. And SpaceX launches, even though it's among the Falcon 9, so one third of the Falcon Heavy launching today, hopefully, is one of the most powerful rockets in the world, and yet it's pretty much the cheapest one among the big rockets. SpaceX sells its Falcon 9 launches for $62 million. That's the price that you can see on the website.
Yeah, and so like, Yeah.
So maybe in the future. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it's comparable. So, for example, its main, like, the only U.S. competitor, ULA, United Launch Alliance, sells the smallest version of the Atlas V for $90 million, and it used to be something like $140 million before the competitive pressure of SpaceX. And that's a much less capable rocket. Once you upgrade it to be comparable to SpaceX, it's going to be more than 200 or like 250, I think, million dollars. A lot of money.
So yeah, compared to $60 million, it's a lot more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, Space Shuttle, you know, NASA's Space Shuttle is probably the most iconic rocket of all times.
Yeah, it was like a semi airplane and semi rocket,
This big orbiter on top was strapped with this massive orange tank and these two side boosters, and then it just glides back to Earth, right?
Yeah.
And the idea behind Space Shuttle was to achieve a simple and cheap reusable rocket system. The idea was that the orbiter launches and lands multiple times, and so it's reusable, so it's cheap. And there's this big orange tank, which is expendable, so it's only used once, but it's just a dumb tank.
Yeah.
And then the side boosters, which are solid rocket fuel boosters. So essentially, they're metal pipes filled with extremely big fireworks.
Yeah.
They would also crash land into the sea, and they would be towed back to port and refurbished and launched again, right?
Yeah.
And the idea behind that is that because we're reusing most of the elements of the system, it's going to be cheap.
Yeah.
But it never was. When you calculate the whole inflation-adjusted cost of the whole space shuttle program and divide it by the number of launches, which was a big number, it flew for a couple of decades, right? From somewhere in the 70s, I think, or early 80s, I don't remember exactly. And the last launch was in 2011. So a long time, it had, you know, more than 100 launches. But still, when you divide it by the number of launches, the total cost, it comes down to $1 billion.
But per launch or the whole thing?
Per launch.
Per launch?
$1 billion per launch.
Wow. Okay, that's... It's so, a lot more than $60 million.
So yeah. Let's just say the plan failed.
So like $100 billion like burned, actually.
Wow. Yeah, like 16 times more expensive. Yeah. Now, of course, Space Shuttle had some capabilities that this, you know, that Falcon 9 doesn't have. Sure, but the point is that for a launch system for cargo to the low Earth orbit, it's a failure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Even though it flew for so long, but only because it's a government thing. You know, NASA did it, but it was heavily, you know, it was all subsidized.
Yeah, but the thing is, you know, before we continue, like for a consumer like me, I remember how mind-blowing was when I realized that really the rockets are not reusable. Like I really assumed they were before I, you know, started to understand the thing, because I thought, how can that be that the rocket launches and then it just disintegrates, goes to the sea and whatever, like, and or just is being, you know, thrown as a trash on the orbit, you know, and then just goes, it sits there. So like millions of dollars of equipment, they're just going to be used once, right? And then I remember there was it was a joke or a story, like saying, you know, imagine that you're flying on you're flying from Warsaw to New York, and then once you land in New York, the airplane disintegrates,
yeah.
And you have to have another one to come back. So it's crazy. It's like for regular consumers, I guess, like for me, it was a problem that you don't realize how this works. So how big of a breakthrough it is to have a rocket that launches and the rocket that comes back and just, you know, is being reused again.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, airplanes are not cheap. A smallish plane like 737 or Airbus A320 costs something like $60 to $100 million. So it's in, you know, Falcon 9 range.
Yeah.
And
but then they're used for like 20 years or something.
Yeah, exactly. And Airbus A380, the biggest airplane on the planet, is something like $300 or $400 million. So it's just as expensive, but it's not a cost. It's capital, right? You invest it, but then you amortize it over, you know, thousands and thousands of flights, and on each flight, hundreds and hundreds of passengers, and it turns out that I can fly to Spain for $25.
Exactly.
How amazing is that, right? But if you use a rocket once, then it doesn't work. But the thing is, like, it's not as simple as saying, hey, let's just reuse it, because Space Shuttle tried to do it and it failed. Like, it was technically speaking reusable, or I guess more fittingly refurbishable, because it took a ton. Like, it was essentially dismantled into tiny pieces and then brought back together.
Okay.
So it was not cheap to refurbish it and launch again.
Okay.
Right? But now, like, you're starting to think, okay, so what's the difference? What makes it such that SpaceX, as this, you know, small company, this entrant in this industry, which was until now, it was all government contractors.
Yeah, NASA and everything.
Well, NASA, but you know, Space Shuttle wasn't built by NASA. It was contracted, like the actual manufacturing was, and much of the design and the details was done by companies like Boeing, like Lockheed Martin.
Okay, so the typical suspect, the usual suspects.
Yeah, 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 like big government contractors, right? And some of the differences in price just come down to this. NASA is a big government bureaucracy. There's a whole complicated story of Air Force getting involved in the design of Space Shuttle and blah, blah, blah. And there's this whole thing about how rockets designed in the past were built on a contracting basis as cost plus basis with the government. So essentially the government, the US government tells you, okay, so this is what we want to achieve. You build this and we'll pay you whatever it costs you to build plus this extra so that you can make profit off of it.
Plus the margin.
But, and then there is no incentive to cut costs. In fact, there's every incentive to make it as complicated, as expensive as possible, and just use negotiation to convince whoever pays you that it's necessary, because you don't have sort of structural incentive to make it cheap.
You're right. Yeah, that's true.
But then there's a bunch of other things that makes SpaceX very much different. Like, this mindset completely changes when it's not something you contract, when SpaceX is not a contractor, but it's a company built from ground up, like from the initial $100 million that Elon Musk invested in it, and like every penny that's spent on making the first, you know, comparatively speaking, tiny Falcon 1 rocket, like everything that goes inside it is like money from your boss's pocket. So cash, right? But it's commercial. it's like building a startup. Well, maybe not startup, VC, but a small bootstrapped company. Mm-hmm. A completely different mindset, and you start thinking about things completely differently. So, for example, traditionally in aerospace, in rocketry, people thought of efficiency, sort mm-hmm. of raw technical efficiency of things, and you'd choose the solution that's sort of best in theory, right?
Yeah.
So, for example, orbital rockets are generally have two stages: a big booster stage and a small stage on top that then separate, and then the second stage ignites and actually takes it to orbit. And this is just basic math. Like you need to have a big rocket, but once you burn through most of the fuel, you have a big heavy tank. So you just throw away the dead weight
and the burden.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then you have a small a small rocket on top of the rocket.
Okay.
And generally, the first and second stage of rockets were two completely different designs.
Okay.
And some of it has to do with history and like a different way of thinking about efficiency. So, for example, the Atlas V rocket, which is U.S. main competitor, but it's built by collaboration of Boeing and Lockheed Martin. So it's essentially like a rocket built for the U.S. government, even though it's mm-hmm. it's sort of launched by a commercial entity. And the Atlas V rocket is Atlas Centaur. It's the Atlas booster and the Centaur second stage. And the Centaur has its own history dating back to the 50s. And so it evolved in its own life. And the idea when you're building an Atlas V is, why design this new second stage when we have this perfectly fine second stage that's great?
Okay.
Right? But it comes from the mindset that it's already built and it doesn't matter how much it costs. It's already designed, it's built, so just let's use that. And another aspect of it is you generally use two very different types of engines.
Yeah.
Very often for the first stage, you have a big, powerful kerosene engine mm-hmm. because they have a lot of thrust. So, they have a lot of initial power. And then on the second stage, you would use hydrogen as the fuel because it will have generally less thrust. It's like tiny engines, but it's very highly efficient. So you get mm-hmm. a lot of thrust or impulse, speaking mm-hmm. technically. So thrust over time mm-hmm. per kilogram of fuel.
Yeah.
And the idea behind that is that at liftoff you need as big of a thrust to weight of the rocket ratio to mm-hmm. minimize what's called gravity losses. Mm-hmm. So every second that you're not in orbit, you're sort of wasting part of your thrust because like you're thrusting up and the Earth wants to bring you down. Yeah. So you want to have as big of a thrust to weight ratio, but then once you're in orbit, none of that matters. You don't have gravity losses, mm-hmm. right? You're in orbit. So what matters is the raw efficiency because building a hydrogen first stage is very difficult, mm-hmm. right? So that's the traditional mindset that hydrogen second stage is better in like pure technical sort of idealized way. It's better.
Yeah.
But the thing is, when you start to think like when it's your money on the line to design a brand new rocket, it's insane because hydrogen is very difficult to deal with. It's, liquid hydrogen is just 20 Kelvin above absolute zero.
There is a reason why I remember in one of the expos when I was a student in the year 2000, so 18 years ago, I saw a working prototype of a BMW car with hydrogen engine. Mm-hmm. And still, hydrogen engines are not the norm for the cars.
And they won't be.
And they won't be, exactly.
Yeah, and like cryogenic hydrogen is even more difficult. Like hydrogen makes metal brittle. Okay.
Uh-huh.
If you pour liquid hydrogen into a metal tank, which is not super specially prepared, the tiny hydrogen molecules will find their way in between molecules of the metal and make it brittle. I mean, it's super hard to deal with.
Yeah.
Right? And you have two very different designs of the engines. You have to design two different engines with two different fuels. It's
You're
insane.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And SpaceX, like, they were like, no. Like, if we need more... If the second stage is not efficient and we need more power to achieve, some payload mass to a higher orbit, we'll just make the second stage bigger, you know, big deal. And we'll just design one engine and use it there. Now, the thing is that for the second stage, you just need a little small engine. So what did SpaceX do? Normally, you have just one massive engines on the bottom of the first stage. But they were like, no, let's just design one version of the same engine. And just on the first stage, just let's just put nine of them.
Okay.
Hence Falcon 9, because it has nine Merlin engines.
Okay.
Right? And it's sort of, it's not something that you do normally. Saturn V, the most powerful rocket in the history, had five engines on the first stage, but just because it was so massively powerful, like there was no other way back then to do it. But this is like very unusual. And so the second stage of the Falcon 9 is inefficient. It has oversized engine, but so what? It works and it's perfectly fine. And Falcon 9 is still among the most powerful rockets on the planet. And yet it does these things which are inefficient, but it's fine because you can easily scale things up, but you don't have to design two different things.
Well, I like that because the way they designed it, as you said, there are trade-offs. I mean, you know, if they want to choose to have one type of engine, they have to settle for some trade-offs. But that's the thing. The question they were asking, you know, how can we optimize? How can we make it cheaper? How can we make it reusable? How can we make it, you know, the cheapest design, you know, so that we don't have to design completely different things? Because when you have infinite budget, you can create infinite number of engines, no problem. But if you don't, then you have to decide. And then of course, maybe then the second stage is not ideal, but if it's fine and if it gets the job done, then it's okay.
Yeah, exactly. And like you can see parallels to what we do, that it makes especially a lot of sense for us when we're designing our app to strive for consistency. Like when we have a one like type of thing, like we can tweak it here and there and it's technically better, but like we can also save a lot of time, like development time, just reusing the same components over and over again with as little variance as possible.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. And this is what we're doing all the time. I mean, this is why we with such a small team can deliver an app for so many platforms.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, we are trying to get the best from each, but then again, find some common denominator. And of course, we're upping our game all the time right now. But the thing is, there are some trade-offs. But then again, the question is, you know, what's the benefit? What's the ultimate benefit? And the ultimate benefit, for example, in our case, for the customer, is to have a consistently working app, you know, that just gets the job done. And that's the thing, you know, some people might like it, some people might not like it, but it's our decision, you know, to do. And it is one of our decisions also not to grow our team exponentially just because we want to serve another platform.
Yeah, exactly. There's ton of little examples like that. Like SpaceX is like, you know, why make things harder? So for example, a lot of like LS5, the big government rocket, right?
Is it the one that you have built on Lego, or is it a different one?
No. That's Saturn V.
Okay.
The one that brought us to the moon.
Okay.
Right. But the Atlas V has the first stage, the skin of the first stage, the big tank, is sort of built like a massive MacBook Pro, in the sense that it has this construction which is called isogrid. So you start from a thick piece of aluminium and then you mill it so that it has a very thin skin and then ridges in this isogrid sort of triangular shape. And it's a very, you know, it's this construction that's very lightweight and super, you know, it's very rigid and strong for very little material.
Like the unibody of the MacBook
Pro. Yeah, like a unibody of the MacBook Pro, exactly. Okay. But except for being a MacBook Pro, it's like 50 meters long and 3 meters in diameter.
Right.
It's super expensive to do.
Yeah.
It's better in theory. But like, again, like why?
Mm-hmm.
Just roll tanks from sheet metal, weld together, rings and stringers.
Yeah.
And it's fine, right? Mm-hmm. You can make it longer so that to to make for the lost efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a big deal, right? So why sort of add additional things that's not necessary? Or another thing is use of new technologies, like in the Dragon capsule that brings cargo and soon astronauts to the International Space Station. There's these Super Draco engines, which are 3D printed from Iconel, which is this super strong metal alloy, right?
Mm.
And so 3D printing is really interesting because on one hand, you get things which are not as strong in some ways because you're just, you know, you have metal dust and you're just whizzing laser across it to sort of make the pieces of metal stick together.
Mm-hmm.
It has some sort of structural flaws. But then again, when you have an engine, you have a lot of like internal complexities that have to be there. And instead of making like milling or using other traditional manufacturing methods to make 100 pieces that have to fit together, and then you need to, you know, weld them together, or they have to be bolted together or
mm-hmm.
something like that, you can manufacture it in one piece. You know, there are things you can do with 3D printing that you can't do otherwise, right? And so you use things which are unproven, and you know, people who are conservative are like, you know, we don't know about it, sort of, it has flaws, and you're like, okay, you know, we can deal with flaws, we can work around it, but we can make it for much cheaper.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Or another like interesting story. Falcon 9 has a very unusual shape for a rocket because it's super long and super skinny.
Mm-hmm.
And you think like, it doesn't make sense. Like from like, is it necessary for aerodynamics? That doesn't make sense. In fact, it's really bad at aerodynamics because it's so long that it's like at high speed through thick atmosphere, it's like a noodle, right? It bends. You need like they literally need a few accelerometers and need to get the average to get the actual direction of the rocket because it bends so much. So that's not ideal. So why is it so long and skinny? And the reason why is because those damn things are so large that they're difficult to transport. You know,
mm-hmm.
in the age of Amazon, we don't think about logistics, transportation as a problem. But when you have a rocket that's, you know, that's really thick and really long, getting that from one coast of the US to another is a big deal.
Right.
And so, again, as an example, the Atlas V, the SpaceX competitor, what they do is they have, I believe, a custom-built ship,
mm-hmm.
an actual ship. And they roll to, you know, they roll the rocket inside the ship, and then it goes through the the Mississippi River. I'm not sure. It goes through some river to the bay, and then it sort of goes around America and gets to Florida. And when you need to launch from California, because that also happens, you need to make a long trip through Panama to get to the other ocean and get to California.
Right.
That's pretty insane. So Falcon 9 first stage is literally the largest possible body.
Mm-hmm.
It's the longest possible and the largest diameter possible that you can transport on the truck.
On the truck?
Just on the truck.
On the road.
Yeah. So that's why.
So there you go. You're driving and then like, oh, here's the rocket for you. Hey, here's Falcon. Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
Yeah. You know, a truck, and that's why it has such a suboptimal shape, because you know what, you can save a lot of money by not having your own little navy.
This is a funny thing that which you said, that in the age of logistics we don't think about it. Whenever I order something from Amazon, it just magically appears on my doorstep. Like
mm-hmm.
I don't think how many things or how many places are involved in getting it to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. Another thing about SpaceX that's really interesting and also very relevant, I think, to our industry is that with rockets, there's a large stake when you
mm-hmm.
launch, because first of all, like it's really expensive to build a rocket. It's very expensive. It takes a lot of time, and on top of it, sits an expensive payload. You can have, you know, a telecommunications satellite which is $100 or $200 million. Or what if you have a one-of-a-kind, you know, NASA scientific mission which might cost $1 billion, or a, you know, or a, one of the US spy satellites, which also costs, you know, $500 or $1 billion.
And any mistake can just completely destroy the rocket. Like any small, you know, not thing not matching there can just completely destroy the whole thing.
Yeah. Now, now here's the thing about rockets. The reason why they're hard is because the margins are very low. So in a car, something like 5% of the mass of the car is fuel.
Yeah.
Okay. In an airplane, it's something like 50% of the mass is fuel. In a rocket, it's like 95% of the whole mass is fuel.
All right.
Okay. The Falcon 9, the dry Falcon 9 is something like 30 metric tons, and the full Falcon 9 is something like 560 metric tons.
Wow.
It's a lot of fuel. So, you know, in theory, you could, like, it's not that hard, you know, just to build something that can withstand, you know, all of the drag, the atmospheric, you know, things to build a rocket engine. You know, it's not easy, but it's not that hard. There is the problem is to make it easy, relatively speaking, would to make it so heavy that it would not launch. And that's the problem, that it's, you know, it takes 10,000 things to be right, to for everything to go right, and just one thing to fail, and the thing explodes.
Exactly, the thing explodes.
Right? Mm-hmm. And the rocket is gone, the payload is gone, and if you explode too early, the rocket pad is gone, and it takes a year to fix.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So the stakes are really high. And so that's a large part of the reason why rockets are so expensive. Because you have to make everything perfect.
Mm-hmm.
There's no space for mistakes. But the way SpaceX thinks about perfection is not just through like very bureaucratic red tape, you know, 10 times checking every single thing and using the most expensive way of doing everything to triple and quadruple check everything. But they do a lot of testing.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is that if it's not testable, they won't do it. So for example, in most rockets, the way you separate stages or you separate the payload fairing from the top of the rocket is using pyrotechnic bolts.
Yeah.
So pyrotechnic bolts is essentially a bolt that has an explosive inside.
Dynamite.
Yeah, a tiny bit of dynamite, let's say. And once it's time to separate, you just, you know, you put electric current through it and it separates into two parts.
Mm-hmm.
It's simple, it's perfect, we've done it for 60 years, it works. The problem is that you can't test it. It's untestable. Either it works or it fails, and you have no way of knowing beforehand.
All right, of course, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or for example, the ascent engine of the lunar landing module in the Apollo program. The way the engine was built was also such that it was not fully really testable, right? Like it works or it doesn't. And if it doesn't, you're...
So the only solution is you pray a lot.
Yeah, a lot and hard, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they don't do that. Instead of pyrotechnic bolts, all of the separation events is done using hydraulics.
Mm-hmm. Ah, hydraulic.
Right?
Okay.
Mm-hmm. There are no solid fuels. Everything is liquid fuel because you can't test solid fuels. Once you ignite a solid fuel, you just burn through it. You have no way of stopping it. You have no way of controlling it or throttling it.
Okay.
It works or it doesn't. So when you test a solid rocket booster, is you build a solid rocket booster, you burn through it, and then you build another one. So it's sort of...
It's not really a test.
It's not really...
It's actually a launch.
Yeah, just on the ground,
exactly.
Right? Like on the side.
Yeah.
And the engines were built from the very beginning. The rocket engines were built such that they can be easily and rapidly lighted again. And most, even, you know, liquid rocket fuel engines are built such that, sure, they can be fired again, but you know, they have to be prepared again. It takes a lot of time. You have to like replace things, and even before, you know, reusing the whole rockets, they built it from the scratch such that they can test it multiple times. So normally the way you launch a rocket is you build the whole rocket, you do a lot of inspection and stuff, but you build the rocket, you put it on the pad, you do what's called a wet dress rehearsal. Mm-hmm. So essentially you do all of the steps, the procedure of launch, except for pressing launch, except for firing the engines.
Yes.
Okay. And then once you launch and it works or it doesn't.
So you want to just, like, the only thing you can test is if everything until launch works.
Mm-hmm. Now what SpaceX does is they manufacture the individual engines, and each individual engine is fire tested as one unit in Texas. They just put it on the engine stand and they fire the engine. If it works, it's shipped back to California. They put the whole rocket together. They bring it to Texas. They put it on a test stand, and they do a full scale firing test. So they fuel it until the top. They do the whole launch procedure without launching. It's held by the clamps, and it's fired for a minute.
So they don't burn through the whole fuel.
They burn for most of it. Sometimes they do like actual the whole fuel, which is 2.5 minutes. But generally they do like 15-30 minute fires. So they test all of that. Then they bring it to the launch pad and they do static fire. So they erect the rocket and they do all the procedure. It's like wet dress rehearsal, but they also fire the engines for like 3 seconds. So it takes about 3 seconds for the engines to rev up to full thrust. And if it's okay, the engines are shut down and everything is good. And then two or 3 days later, they launch. So
okay.
Every engine is fired 3 times before the launch. And then every engine is fired the 4th time during the launch. And then if it's brought back to land, 3 of the engines are fired 3 more times for the boost back burn, the re-entry burn, and the landing burn. And or not the landing burn, but the central engine will be fired the total of 7 times for one mission. And then if it relaunches, then it's going to be fired a bunch of more times, right?
Okay.
And it's built so that you can do it. It's designed from scratch to be very testable.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And every component, like there's a massive amount of code. Like there's a massive amount of computer stuff in such a rocket.
Yeah.
And all of that, you can sort of hook up the computers of the rocket into a testing computer,
mm-hmm.
which simulates all of the possible scenarios. Throw in nominal values, throw in like test it with things that are not right, and test it just in a simulator.
Mm-hmm.
Test it connected to the actual rocket, and then test all of that. Like just everything is tested a lot of times. And, you know, software testing, like everybody in rocketry does it, sort of, but then you have just ridiculous failures, such as a rocket launching for the wrong inclination because they normally launch it from this pad, and this time they launch it from that pad, and the rocket did not realize that it's from a different position on the planet. Like, just silly things. They're just ridiculous mistakes that are made. There was a Russian Proton rocket launch which failed and sort of flipped around and crashed into the ground because some technician accidentally mounted the accelerometer upside down.
Really?
Yeah, literally.
Wow.
And they didn't catch it because
they don't test.
They don't test.
So so this is like a very important argument for us also in the software.
Yeah.
Like we tend to neglect testing.
Yeah.
And we tend to, when we build software and we build apps, we think, you know, it's going to work. It's going to be fine. But the more complex the application gets, the more complex the software gets, the more testing is important because, you know, you fix one thing here and you have no clue for some reason, or you just didn't know, or the person who did that, they didn't understand the whole concept of the application, that it impacts the other part of the application. And suddenly a strange feature doesn't work because the other feature was new. Right, it was introduced. So it's really important that we embrace it even more.
And the reason why most software is poorly tested is because if you just write spaghetti code and then think about, you know, I think it's time to be serious about testing. Yeah, good luck. Because the way it's designed from scratch, the way it was designed sort of ad hoc, makes it very difficult to add tests.
Exactly.
It, only when you think about testing from the very scratch will it be easy and cheap to test a lot, test everything. Because the way you think about structuring code is just very conducive to just hooking up tests, right? And most code is not written like that.
Yeah. And of course, you can argue that, you know, at what the code that we build, you know, it's not, you know, rocket science, right? And so it's not going to explode or it's not going to... Yeah, it's not. But on the other hand, like in our case, we have, you know, 500,000 users right now. So they're like pretty like in the last year, I think 15 or I don't know, 15 million tasks were done by our users or more. So there is stuff that can go wrong, or that, you know, you don't want a task from one user to show up for another user or something like that. Or you don't want random tasks to be disappearing from your inbox or things like that. You really want to make sure that, you know, this is like... In our case, our software is pretty mission critical. Like people plan their days.
Yeah.
With our software, they wake up in the morning, they open Nozbe, and they start planning their day. So it better work.
Yeah, it's not that what we do is not complex compared to rockets. Mm-hmm. It's just that with rockets, the margin is so small and it's so expensive to build. It takes so much time that it's super hard to do. Like in many respects, rockets are not that hard. It's only because you have to make everything perfect that they're so hard.
And of course, and the blow up is so spectacular. Yeah. It's the same with flights. You know, like so many people are still afraid of flying, which is completely ridiculous.
Yeah.
Like last year in 2017, it was the first year when no commercial airline ever had an accident. Yeah. Ever. In the whole world of millions of flights. So
that's amazing.
That's amazing. This is an amazing feat. And when you think about that and you go and you, I prefer to drive, and you see how many accidents are there, it's like there's no comparison. But yet, if one airplane goes down, it's so spectacular that it scares the hell out of people, and it makes such an impact. Whereas, you know, small accident of a car, like even if people died, nobody cares because there are so many.
Yeah, and most accidents in software, like software is riddled with accidents. It's just most of them are so low stakes.
Exactly.
That it's easy to...
To fix them, you know.
Yeah, it's not a big deal, which makes our job much easier and sort of more fun, because you can play around with things and you know, in most aspects, except for security and stuff, if it fails, it's not that big of a deal, right? But when from the very beginning, you think about it, not in terms of sort of raw, technical, idealized perfection, but you're pragmatic, you cut corners in a smart way such that you do think that in the end we'll make the same result, just as, you know, scaling the rocket instead of using a better second stage engine. Like the end result will be just the same, but it's be much cheaper, much simpler, much easier, right? And when you embrace testing, when you embrace the idea of just simple reusable solutions, it's going to be much easier. And then, like, another thing that makes software much easier to do, and what SpaceX strives for, is sort of economies of scale.
Yeah.
Right? Like with the engines, each Falcon 9 flight tests 10 engines in flight.
Yeah.
Okay, so when they've had something like 40, more than 40 flights in total.
Yeah.
40. It's like 400 engine tests.
Yeah, and because it's the same engine,
yeah,
they can just, you know, make it really perfect or near to perfect.
Yeah, and even though in some respects the Falcon 9 engine is very just simple design, it's sort of primitive in some ways. In other ways, it's one of the most perfected, most efficient rocket engines on the planet. And the reason why is because it's reusable rapidly, it's easy to relight, it's so testable. And because they just put 9 of the same engines instead of making one better engine, they test so many of them that they have so much data that they can push the boundaries further and further. And like the Falcon 9 rocket gets better with software updates. I'm not kidding you.
Yeah.
Like sometimes their capabilities just go higher just because they gathered enough data to have as you know, a large amount of confidence that they can, just by tweaking software, like the you know, tweaking valves, they can increase thrust and still be safe.
Tell this to my car. I have one of the newest cars, and it's got lots of software, lots of things. It's got, the, for example, the CarPlay, the Apple CarPlay. And Apple CarPlay sometimes works.
Yeah.
Okay, very often works. But also, sometimes it doesn't work. And I'm always thinking, yeah, luckily there will be an update, right? Okay, but then how can I get an update from my car? Like, I cannot. So I can get an update on my iPhone, but I cannot get an update on my car. And this is, for example, what blows us, blows our minds, is the Tesla cars. Again, the same thinking, is that you can have over-the-air update to your car, and it just gets better with the software update. And my car is not a Tesla, but it's also very modern. It has lots of code, and I should be able to update it quickly and not wait to go to the service, and then maybe they will update it for me, and then and then usually they will charge some you know, some lots of money for just this small software update. Yeah. So it's crazy stuff.
Yeah, and so I think it's time to wrap up. So I have so many more thoughts about it, obviously.
Oh,
this
yes.
is the short version,
yeah.
built for all of you and built for Michael. Let's hope that the Falcon Heavy launch will be a success.
Yeah, let's see tomorrow. Today.
Or a spectacular failure.
Yeah, we'll be watching it.
Yeah, let's hope it's not a boring failure. If it just like fails to relight, the second stage is going to be boring. If it explodes on pad, at least we get that.
Yeah, there's us wanting blood and everything. But the best part is that we will link to the launch anyway in the show notes, because
right.
when we launch this podcast, the Falcon Heavy will have launched by then.
Yeah.
True or false, success or not, let's see how this goes. Very exciting. And again, it's a very exciting time to be alive, because these things are new and they are really progressing very fast, which is cool.
Yeah, and one request is that if you like this episode, or you have thoughts, or you'd like to hear more about rocketry from me, please email me or tweet me or whatever.
Yeah, after like four episodes of New Year planning, we thought, you know, we totally like had you, like we overplanned it for you guys and for ourselves, indeed. That's why we decided to do something completely different. But, and we want to do some different things on this show, and we have new books coming as well to review. But, you know, if you like the Rocket Corner, which turned into the whole episode, let us know and we'll be back.
All right.